Today's honored guest has long been an advocate of nonviolence and is recognized as the leading figure in the civil rights movement in the United States. He was the youngest man to win the Nobel Peace Prize, winning it at the age of 35. At the present time, in addition to his civil rights activities, he's been one of the leading critics of President Johnson's war policy. It's with great pleasure that I introduce to you the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Thank you very kindly for your heartwarming applause. Someone has said that when an audience applauds you before you speak, that represents faith. When they applaud in the middle of your speech, that represents hope. And when they applaud at the end, that represents love. So you have demonstrated great faith today, and I certainly want to appreciate your very heartwarming applause. I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to have the privilege of coming to this great institution of learning and the privilege of discussing with you some of the vital issues of our day. No one can overlook the fact that the University of California is one of the truly great universities of our world. I think one of the great needs in our world today, and certainly in our nation, is for a revolution of values. And I, for one, appreciate the fact that you here at Berkeley have constantly reminded all of us and our whole nation that we must review our values. And I would also like to express my deep personal appreciation to you as a civil rights leader for the support that you as a university and a concerned student body have given to the civil rights struggle. As we have labored tirelessly and unrelentingly to achieve first-class citizenship, we have had the support of persons of goodwill over our nation, and I would certainly say that some of the strongest support that we have received came from this great campus, this university with students who have a great concern. And I want to thank you because you, in a real sense, have been the conscience of the academic community in our nation. And I can only say, keep up the good work and keep up this great concern. I want to talk with you this afternoon from the subject America's chief moral dilemma. There can be no gainsaying of the fact that America has brought the nation and the world to an awe-inspiring threshold of the future. We have built machines that think and instruments that peer into the unfathomable ranges of interstellar space. We have built gigantic buildings to kiss the sky and gargantuan bridges to span the seas. Through our spaceships, we have carved the highways through the stratosphere, Through our airplanes, we've dwarfed distance and placed time in chains. And through our submarines, we have penetrated oceanic depths. And this is a dazzling picture of our nation's scientific and technological progress. But when we look to the other side, something basic is missing. Our nation suffers from a kind of poverty of the spirit, which stands in glaring contrast to our scientific and technological abundance. Yes, we've learned to fly the air like birds. We've learned to swim the seas like fish. And yet we have not learned the simple art of walking the earth as brothers and sisters. Henry David Thoreau talked once about improved means to an unimproved end. And so often, we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. It seems to me that this is expressed nowhere greater than in the continued existence of racism, poverty, and war. These are the three evils that I want to talk about this afternoon, evils that must be dealt with and problems that must be solved if we are to go on positively and creatively in the days ahead. Racial injustice is still the black man's burden and America's shame. This problem exists today because many Americans would like to have a nation which is a democracy for white Americans, but simultaneously a dictatorship over black Americans. This is one of the great problems that we find today. Now, in the struggle to get rid of racial injustice, there has been some progress, and I would not want to overlook this. For in assault after assault, the movement has profoundly shaken the entire edifice of legal segregation. And I need not go into the movements from the Montgomery bus boycott right on up through the Selma movement of 1965. Movements which literally subpoenaed the conscience of a large segment of the nation to appear before the judgment seat of morality on the whole question of civil rights. But in spite of this, we must recognize that the plant of freedom has grown only a bud and not yet a flower. We must see that the struggle is much more difficult now. For well now 12 years, the civil rights struggle dealt with the system of legal segregation and the syndrome of deprivation and exploitation surrounding this system. Many things were done during those years that we will remember as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But what we must see today is that with Selma and the Voting Rights Act, one phase of development in the civil rights revolution came to an end. Now a new phase has opened. And this new phase is a struggle for genuine equality. Now, in the phase that has now passed, the achievements were obtained at bargain rates. It didn't cost the nation anything to integrate lunch counters. No expenses were involved. No taxes were involved. It didn't cost the nation anything to integrate libraries, motels, and hotels. It didn't cost the nation anything to guarantee the right to vote. Now we are dealing with issues that will cost the nation something in terms of billions of dollars. And the other thing that we must see is that we are now dealing with issues that will demand a radical redistribution of economic and political power. Many of the allies who went with us in the first phase are going in this phase. Many of the people who were with us in Selma and Birmingham were with us because they were sincerely outraged about extremist behavior toward Negroes. The problem was they were against Bull Connor and Jim Clark and their actions and all of their violence expressed openly toward Negroes, but they were not for genuine equality. And the true allies, the new genuine liberals, are the ones who recognize that we are in a new phase and who will go all of the way. And in this context, I think we should see the meaning of the so-called white backlash. And I hope you will understand that the so-called white backlash is merely a new name for an old phenomenon. We must honestly face the fact that there has never been a single solid determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans on the whole question of racial equality. On the Statue of Liberty, we read that America is the mother of exiles. But it doesn't take us long to realize that America has been the mother, in most instances, of its white exiles from Europe. It has never evinced that kind of maternal care and concern for its black exiles who were brought to this country in chains from Africa. And it is no wonder that in one of the sorrow songs of early days, the Negro could cry out, "Sometimes I feel like a motherless child." What we see is a constant moving forward, taking a step forward on the question of racial justice, and then taking a step backwards at the same time. In 1863, through the Emancipation Proclamation, the nation freed the Negro from the bondage of physical slavery. The Negro was not given land to make that freedom meaningful. And we must never forget that at the same time, our nation was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that America was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor, while refusing to undergird its black peasants who were brought here in chains from Africa with the same kind of economic floor. Therefore, emancipation for the Negro was freedom to hunger. It was freedom to the winds and rains of heaven. It was freedom without bread to eat, without land to cultivate. It was freedom and famine at the same time. In 1875, the nation passed a civil rights bill and refused to enforce it. In 1964, the nation passed an even weaker civil rights bill, and even to this day, it has not been enforced in all of its dimensions. In 1954, the Supreme Court declared segregation unconstitutional in the public schools. And now we find ourselves 12 or 13 years later with less than 5% of the Negro students of the Deep South attending integrated schools. And if it continues at this pace, it will take another 97 years to integrate the public schools of the South. Suburban politicians talk eloquently against open housing and at the same time and in the same breath contend that they are not racist. All of these things reveal that the white backlash is nothing new. The fact is that America has been backlashing on the question of fundamental human rights for its black citizens for more than 300 years. And so we must not allow anybody to take our eyes from the real problem. I condemn riots as strongly as anybody, but riots did not cause the white backlash. Nobody had rioted in Watts when the state of California voted out of existence a fair housing bill. There were no chance of black power when four innocent, unoffending, beautiful Negro girls were killed in a church in Birmingham, Alabama, and nothing has been done about it to this very day. We must see the problem where it is. The problem is that white America, and I don't mean all white Americans, but white America has never solidly committed itself on the question of racial justice. And it means that now we must gird our courage. And those who are committed to the struggle for justice and freedom must work harder than ever before. For I'd assure you that we need this kind of activity and this kind of work more than we had it even in the first phase. I know that we're going through a period where there are understandable suspicions in some segments of the Negro community concerning the commitment of white Americans. And I can understand this feeling psychologically and otherwise. No one must allow this feeling to make us feel that the Negro can do this job all by himself. Somehow we must work together, realize that by working together and creating constructive, committed alliances, we can go on in the days ahead. And I, for one, am convinced that there are still thousands, even though they represent a numerical minority, of white persons in this country, many of whom are under the sound of my voice right now, who cherish justice and democratic principles above privilege, and who are willing to go with us all the way. And this is why I can still sing without any reluctance, black and white together we shall overcome. Now, the second evil that I would like to mention is the evil of poverty. Like a monstrous octopus, it extends its nagging, prehensile tentacles in villages and cities all over our nation. Some 40 million of our brothers and sisters are poverty-stricken. Many of them go to bed hungry at night. I've seen them with my own eyes. I've lived with them in the ghettos of our nation. Some of them are Indians. Some are Mexican-American. Some are Puerto Rican. Some are Appalachian whites. The largest group in terms, in proportion to its size in the population, is the American Negro. Negroes and poor people generally find themselves today smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. Now, something must be done about this. Something must be done about it quickly. When we look at the Negro community, for an instance, we are facing a major depression every day. The unemployment rate among Negroes is set forth by the Labor Department at 8.4%. Unemployment in the nation general is about 4%. But they don't deal with all of the facts because they are dealing with statistics that can be gathered as a result of people who've been in the labor market and those who still go to the employment office to try to find work. They aren't dealing with the hundreds and thousands of discouraged Negroes, many of whom have lost hope. They've had so many doors closed in their faces. They've come to conclude that life is a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They've lost motivation. There may be another 7 or 8% in that category, which means that the unemployment rate among Negroes may well be 16%. Among some young people, among the youth in the Negro community, in some cities it goes up as high as 35% and 40%. If the nation as a whole confronted what the Negro is presently confronting economically, we would be in a major depression more staggering than the depression of the 30s. And it's not only unemployment. Most of the poor people are working every day, but earning so little money, they cannot begin to gain the basic necessities of life. Something must be done about this. Ultimately, a great nation is a compassionate nation. Ultimately, a great person is concerned about the least of these. And I contend that we still have poverty in America today because there are still all too many people who are trying to be conscientious objectors in the war against poverty. There's somewhere else we ought to be conscientious objectors, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, but not in the war against poverty. The problem is, you see, we have the resources in America to end poverty. The question is whether we have the will. And if we are to end poverty, there must be a tremendous reordering of priorities. Senator Harkey estimated the other day that we spend $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier in Vietnam. When you look at the other side, it's tragic. We spend only $53 a year for every person that's considered poverty-stricken, and half of that goes for salaries for those who are not poor. The question is, what are we trying to win today? I'm afraid that the administration of our nation is more concerned about winning an unwinnable war in Vietnam than about winning the war against poverty right here at home. Now this leads me to the next evil. It is the evil of war. And nowhere does this evil express today more than in the tragic, unjust, evil war in Vietnam. It's tragic that we got in it from the very beginning. As Professor Cominger has said, this tragic war is a product of a gigantic miscalculation that the world after 1945 was and would remain divided into two great blocks, one representing light and the other darkness, and that we who represented the light stood at Armageddon and battled for the Lord. And somehow we moved right on with those miscalculations. This war is the product of a gigantic miscalculation about China and about Asia, probably the largest and most fearful miscalculation in diplomatic history. The notion that Chiang Kai-shek represented the true China, that the communists did not represent China and were not really here to stay and need not therefore be recognized. It was as if Britain and France had gone on recognizing the Confederacy as the legitimate government of the United States 20 years after Appomattox. Is the product of an almost demonic delusion that we were not only called upon to set and keep the rest of the world straight, but that we had the material, intellectual, and moral resources to do this. It is a product of grave miscalculations that because we were a world power, we had power and could use it everywhere in the world. And out of this melancholy body of obsessions and miscalculations have come those notions now so familiar that we, not the United Nations, are the peacekeeping instrument of the modern world. Once accept these assumptions almost paranoid in their sweeping vastness, and our war in Vietnam takes on a kind of nightmarish logic. This war has all of the dimensions of a Greek tragedy. And oh, it has done so much damage to our nation. As a result of this war, we have seriously impaired the United Nations. We have forfeited the support of our allies. And so today the United States stands morally and politically isolated in the world. We have greatly strengthened the forces of reaction in our country and excited violence and hatred among our people. We have strengthened the military-industrial complex, which even President Eisenhower once warned us against. Then we have blocked the self-determination of a people. And whether people in our country realize it or not, in large numbers, We are in the tragic position in the war in Vietnam of engaging in a process that perpetuates white colonialism covered up with certain niceties of complexity. As a result of this war, we have diverted attention from civil rights. When the guns of war become a national obsession, social programs are thrown in the background. Consciences are not aroused as much about the injustices still existing in the society. People ask, why do you try to tie the issues together, the issues of peace and civil rights? My only answer is that they have tied themselves together. There can be no doubt of the fact that this war has hurt the civil rights movement, and this war is standing in the way of programs that could aid us in dealing with this new phase of the human rights revolution. Another thing about the war in Vietnam is that it has made the principle of dissent one of the chief casualties of the war. And there is a mad attempt today, sometimes overtly and sometimes covertly, to equate dissent with disloyalty, and to say that those who are concerned about withdrawing from Vietnam and ending that war are venal enemies of our soldiers. Well, I want the record to show that I'm against the war, and one of the reasons, along with many, is that I see so many fine, bright, promising young men taken out of society, taken out of school, sent away to fight in this unjust war. And what we are saying is that we are our boys' best friends because we want them to come home. It's time to come home from Vietnam. Casualty of the war in Vietnam is the humility of our nation. Through rugged determination, scientific and technological progress, as I mentioned earlier, we have become the richest and most powerful nation in the world. But honestly impels me to admit that our power has often made us arrogant. We feel that our money can do anything. We arrogantly feel that we have everything to teach other nations and nothing to learn from them. We often arrogantly feel that we have some divine messianic mission to police the whole world. We are arrogant in not allowing young nations to go through the same growing pains, turbulence, and revolution that characterized our own history. We are arrogant in our contention that we have some sacred mission to protect people from totalitarian rule while we make little use of our power to end the evils of South Africa and Rhodesia. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. Many of our senators and congressmen vote joyously to appropriate billions of dollars for the war in Vietnam. And these same senators and congressmen vote loudly against a fair housing bill to make it possible for a Negro veteran of Vietnam to purchase a decent home. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. We are willing to make the Negro 100% of a citizen in warfare, but reduce him to 50% of a citizen on American soil. And so of all the good things in life, the Negro has approximately one half those of whites. Of the bad things, he has twice those of whites. Thus, half of all Negroes live in substandard housing, and Negroes have half the income of whites. When we turn to the negative experiences of life, the Negro has a double share. There are twice as many unemployed. The infant mortality rate is double that of white. And there are twice as many Negroes dying in Vietnam as whites in proportion to their size in the population. And all of this tells us that our nation has a great deal to do in using its vast resources of power to solve the problems facing our nation and facing mankind. And the other thing about this war in Vietnam is that it has increased the possibilities of all-out nuclear warfare, and therefore it has increased the possibilities of the destruction of all mankind. And I must say to you honestly this afternoon, and I'm sad to say it, but I fear that the clouds of the Third World War a hovering mighty low. And if there is a Third World War which can destroy the whole of mankind, our government will have to take the chief responsibility for making this a reality. So I have a moral obligation to speak against this war and to take a stand wherever I can. And I want to commend all of you that have participated in some way. And I urge you to continue. This summer, there will be an opportunity for thousands of students to work in communities all over our nation. And a kind of teach out, knocking on doors, talking with people about the war in Vietnam, giving them the facts about the war, developing statistics on the number of people opposed to the war. And the aim is to build a powerful peace bloc that can really have influence in the 1968 elections. And we must make it clear that we aren't going to let our political forces and the politicians ignore Vietnam in 1968. This must be an issue if that tragic war is still going on. And so as the war hawks escalate the war in Vietnam, we must escalate our protest against the war.
Thank you.
reporter said to me the other day, Dr. King, don't you think you're hurting your influence? Don't you think by taking a stand against the war in Vietnam, you are losing many people who once respected you? They will no longer listen to you now. Don't you think you must kind of move back, go more toward the administration's policy? And I looked at this reporter and said, I'm sorry, sir, but you don't know me. I'm not a consensus leader. I went on to tell him that I do not determine what is right or wrong by going out taking a Gallup poll of the majority opinion. Ultimately, a genuine leader is not a searcher for consensus, but a molder of consensus. On some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there are times in life that you must take a stand that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but you take it because it is right. And that is where I stand. As I move toward my conclusion, let me say that there is a need in our country for a kind of creative discontent. There are certain technical words that are used in every academic discipline. They soon become stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical nomenclature. Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology. It is a word maladjusted. And certainly we all want to live as far as possible the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I must say to you this afternoon, there are some things in our nation and in the world of which I'm proud to be maladjusted, and to which I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good society is realized. I never intend to adjust myself to racial segregation and discrimination. I never intend to become adjusted to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism. But in a day when Sputniks and explorers and Geminis are dashing through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win if that is a world war. We must come to see now that the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat will be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not envision. It may well be that our world is in dire need of a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. and women who will be as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. As maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of his own vacillations about slavery scratched across the pages of history words lifted to cosmic proportions, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Through such maladjustment, I believe that we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. And somehow, I still have faith that keeps me going through these difficult days. I hope that we will develop the coalition of conscience and will solve this problem. I'll tell you why I have the faith, and it is because of universities like this, with thousands of young people, black and white, who have the new vision that we need in this age. And so I haven't lost faith in the future. I think we are going to reach the goal that we seek. And so I can still sing, "We Shall Overcome." I know many can't sing it now, but I can still sing it because I believe the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. And so with this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will move toward that day. And we will transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will speed up the day when all men, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, believers and non-believers, will be able to join hands right in this nation and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Dr. King has consented to ask questions, to answer questions. He already asked them. But before he begins, there are some individuals who would like to make a presentation. If any of you have questions, because there's an enormous amount of people, please try to write them down on something and pass them forward. We have about 20 questions now. We'd like to have some questions that don't repeat every subject. So please pass them forward as rapidly as possible.
Dr. King, among us there are many thousands who have participated in the anti-war movements, the civil rights movements of the past, and many of us are very, very tired of voting for politicians that during election times talk peace and the day after escalate wars. And for these many of thousands of people who feel that, we hastily have drawn up a petition of some 50 student and faculty leaders of the peace, civil rights, student movements on this campus, and we address ourselves to one question. We ask a choice in 1968 to vote against war. We ask that choice be independent candidates Martin Luther King and Benjamin Spock. Of this we ask.
Dr. King would like to reserve his comment. There are about five questions which ask something relevant to do with that petition. First question is, Dr. King, do you advocate direct political resistance to the draft and the war effort instead of, or in addition to, religious opposition, a doctrine based on belief in a supreme being? If so, in which manner do you recommend today's youth confront the United States government?
First, I think that is absolutely necessary to begin a massive movement through letter writing and other means. Demonstrations are necessary to change the draft laws on this whole question of conscientious objection. As you know, at the present time, it's based mainly on religious views and opposition to all wars, which means that only a pacifist could be accepted as a conscientious objector. I think the time has come for our nation to stop this process of invading the lives and even the convictions of thousands and thousands of young men in our country and give them the opportunity to be conscientious objectors of a particular war. This, I think, is very necessary, and I really think we need a movement around this. And I'm convinced that if this isn't done, thousands and thousands, and I believe it's growing every day, of young men who find this war objectionable and abominable are going to choose jail rather than going to fight in Vietnam.
Dr. King, will you be our candidate in 1968?
Well, I must say that it's very kind of you to even express such concern and make such a request. I do think we have some major decisions to make in 68, and I do feel that we may be caught in a situation where we have the administration's policy being expressed by the administration itself and the Republican candidate running with the same policy or even a policy to the right of the administration. Now, that would happen if Brother Nixon got the nomination. And, of course, I certainly wouldn't come to California and talk about your good governor. But people may have to choose between Johnson, a Reagan, and a Wallace. That's a pretty... But in all seriousness, I think we are faced with some... I think we're faced with some difficult decisions, and it may be necessary for a kind of third force to come into being where those persons who cannot in good conscience follow the policy of the administration, a policy of continued escalation of the war in Vietnam and continued fighting of this war will have to turn elsewhere. Now, I do not feel that I'm presidential timber. I am committed to trying to do this job of civil rights and this job of building wherever we can more opposition to the war in Vietnam, and this would certainly take all of my time. And I would rather think of myself as one trying desperately to be the conscience of all of the political parties rather than being a political candidate, whether it's for a political candidate in a serious sense or to serve as a channel for a protest vote. I think there are good people that could be turned to for this, and I must frankly say that I have no ambitions or intentions in this area, and I hope that those who have raised this will understand that it's a part of my deep convictions to put all of my time now in trying to build the opposition to the war and also to deal with the great problems that we have in the civil rights movement. And I've just never thought of myself, and I can't now think of myself as a politician. Of course, I do have sense enough to know that I couldn't win either.
Dr. King, how do you view Stokely Carmichael's approach to the civil rights movement?
Well, I would prefer to reverse the question. I got that question today, and the question in substance said that that Stokely Carmichael had harmed the civil rights movement. And I had answered by saying that the forces in our nation that continue to vacillate on the question of racial justice and the forces that allow certain conditions that are intolerable to exist and continue to exist are doing much more harm to civil rights than Stokely Carmichael. I think also there may be points that some would disagree with in Stokely's philosophy, but I do think he has raised some very fundamental questions that we must all recognize. The great dilemma of the Negro in the ghetto is his powerlessness, and it is necessary to transform that powerlessness into creative and constructive power. We do need political and economic power. Power is nothing but the ability to achieve purpose. It's the ability to effect change. And I think we should recognize that those who are speaking of black power have at least brought that point out, and a point that we've tried to stress all along. I think the other thing that we must see is the necessity for a powerful psychological call to manhood in the Negro community. This is absolutely needed because of our bruised history, because for so long we were forced to believe that we were nobody. We became ashamed of our heritage, ashamed of our color, ashamed of our hair and everything else. And this was tragic. Now what we are saying is that we will assert our manhood, and this is something that is needed for growth. You see, our language messed us up here too, and we have a problem of semantics in a sense. If you will run through Roger's thesaurus, you'll find about 125 synonyms for black. They are all degrading, something evil, something low. And then when you get those 118 synonyms for white, this is all something chaste, pure, high, noble, worthy, you see. And so Negro children end up every day being taught 125 ways to think of themselves as inferior, and white children end up every day 118 times learning themselves how to feel superior. And you know, it runs right through the language, anything, any experience. We think of black as something degrading, so and that which is white is better. A white lie is better than a black lie. That's the way the society goes. And so that everything degrading, and even that which is passing off or dying, is when you go to a funeral, the hearse is black, the suit you have to wear is black, and everything, so that the language has given the impression that black is degrading and black is something that is unworthy. And what we are saying now is that black is beautiful, and as beautiful as any color in the world. Now let me go on to say that however much I understand, I do feel that I must assert my own principles about black separatism. And I think we'll have to understand what brought the mood at points of black separatism into being. But I have to look at the fact that if the problem is to ultimately be solved, we must face the fact that there is no separate black path to power and fulfillment that does not intersect white roots. The problem is that we are dealing with problems in civil rights now that are human problems. And in order to solve them, you've got to get people on all levels to work to bring them about. We are dealing with poverty, for instance, which, as I said earlier, is larger than the black man. And the only way you can get rid of poverty and the only way you can get rid of slums would be through billions of dollars. And, of course, in order to do this, we've got to have constructive alliances of the real forces of commitment and goodwill, so that if there's any feeling that we can move down a separate black path to power, then I don't believe this. And I think it's also necessary to say on the other side that there is no separate white path to power and fulfillment, short of social disaster, that does not recognize the need of sharing that power with black aspirations for freedom and dignity. You see, for too long we thought of integration as in a romantic or aesthetic sense, and it merely added color to a still predominantly white power structure. More and more we've got to think of integration also in political terms, where you have shared power. And so many people, thinking of it merely in aesthetic terms, will say, oh, we have an integrated community. Our neighborhood is integrated. We have two Negro families. A labor union will say, our union is integrated from top to bottom. We have 100,000 Negro members, and we even have two members on our board of 45. And that becomes integration, you see. And, of course, integration is always moved toward the white community. It's the Negro going to some white rather than, again, an interchange. And I think it is very necessary to see all of this. And I would say that these questions have been raised, many of them have been raised by Stokely Carmichael. And these questions need to be raised. Now, the final point that I'd like to bring out is that I'm not sure of Stokely's views on violence versus nonviolence. He says these questions are irrelevant. I think you know my views on that, and I don't need to go into it in a long sense. I still believe that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom and justice. Now, I don't mean a weak emotion. Many people think of nonviolence as something weak. They fail to see that there is a masculinity and strength in nonviolence when it's truly organized and it takes great courage. Many people confuse non-resistance to evil with non-violent resistance. Non-violent resistance does resist. And I do not see the possibility, even in practical terms, of the Negro winning a violent revolution in the United States. We have to study history here. And history tells us that no violent revolution is won unless the practices, those who are practicing the violence and seeking to overthrow a particular regime, have the support of the non-resisting majority. Now, it may be true that during the Bolshevik Revolution, let us say, that all of the Russian people were not involved in the fighting, but they had the support of the vast majority of people as they were engaged in the fighting. It may be true that Castro has had a few people in the hills, but never forget that Castro had the support and sympathy of more than 95% of the Cuban people in seeking to overthrow the Batista regime. That's one thing that's true in every revolution. The other thing is, in most revolutions, in order to win, you've got to divide the army. A study of revolutions will reveal that the resisting violent force ultimately won the army. Now, I must be honest enough to tell you that I don't think the army, as it is presently structured, are going to aid the Negro in overthrowing anything in that sense. And certainly we wouldn't have the support of the vast majority of American people in a violent revolution. So even in practical terms, I think our best course of action is to develop programs of powerful organization around certain definite aims and objectives and move militantly to the point of achieving them. And I tell you, a mighty good program, as I mentioned earlier, or somewhere today, to solve the problems that I see in the poverty area, we've got to do more than some of the things we're doing now, because this is not even a good skirmish on poverty, much less a war against poverty. We are in dire need of a guaranteed annual income for all American families.
Dr. King is on a very tight schedule and has consented to come to Berkeley today with many other obligations. So there's time for one more question. He has to leave immediately to go to a reception which has been planned for him, so he would appreciate it if the many people who have submitted questions asking to see him could please allow him to go to that reception. Question is, what do you think about the influx of white college students into Negro ghettos to tutor Negro children? Is there any harm done to racial pride, or is racial pride already lacking in the black ghetto?
I personally favor committed white students working in Negro ghettos and working with Negroes. I've never given up on this hope, because I think that the more the Negro who feels hopeless at times and who feels cynical about life is able to see Negroes and whites working and living together in a very committed sense, the more it keeps the lamp of hope burning. And certainly we do need in the ghettos of our country many activities going on, because the conditions are so bad, as you well know. And I think this is one of the very constructive areas. There are many things that can be done and must be done, but the tutorial idea is very important. Now, I do feel that the whites who work in the Negro community must go to work with Negroes and not to do something for Negroes, because this becomes a kind of new level of paternalism. And there must be a complete understanding, a complete empathy a kind of committed empathy, for this is the only way that a white person will be able to function in the ghetto. It's also necessary to understand some of the bitterness in the ghetto. I have to understand it myself, and I certainly know whites have to understand it. I have to go in the ghetto and hear my brothers cursing me out about talking about nonviolence, and I don't run from them. I curse them out. I put my arms around them and try to explain. We must understand the disenchantment and the discontent and even the bitterness. And I think through this period there is need for great compassion and great concern, and this will carry all of us a greater distance in the days ahead. I do want to mention, as I said earlier, the Vietnam Summer Project is underway and the recruiting process is taking place. And here in this area, there is an office. The number is 415, I guess that's the area code, 752-7766. And of course, the other main, I guess we would say, the national headquarters is in Cambridge, Massachusetts at this time. And I certainly want to reiterate the need for your support. In Cambridge, it's 129 Mount Auburn Street. A-U-B-U-R-N, Mount Auburn Street. Now this is, I haven't had a chance to go into the details of this, but my brothers mentioned it to me, and I'm always concerned about my brothers and the problems that we all face. Join Painter Union, local union number 4, and demonstrate against the firing of 3 painters by the Golden Gate Bridge. Now, I don't know the details of this, but I do know that these men have talked with me. They've been fired unjustly, and they've clearly demonstrated this. And there is a protest at the bridge on May 25th at 11 o'clock. It's at Union Square. I'm sorry, Union Square, San Francisco on May 25th. When I'm making a speech, I always have so many requests made to mention something in the speech, and I always end up forgetting some. So if some of you have spoken to me about something that I should have mentioned and I forgot in the process, please forgive me.